Welcome to The Stuck Stops Here, a podcast devoted to cycle breakers. We want to celebrate and empower those who have woken up and decided that toxic generational dysfunction can end with you. My name is Tammy Atman, and I hit rock bottom in 2014, and during those moments of despair, I decided change was my only option. Emotional abuse, both covert and overt, is contagious and leaves invisible scars. The next generation deserves better than what we got. Join me and my amazing co-host and producer, LW, as we have raw and real conversations infused with bad words and humor, designed to inspire awareness, acceptance, and strength. We are not therapists and have no clinical training. You are not alone. Healing does not happen in isolation. Together, all of us can break the familial chains of shame, guilt, fear, and blame. Our stuck can stop here. At the age of four, Dr. Lise DeGeer suffered third-degree burns on 65% of her body as the result of both maternal and corporate negligence. Against the odds, she lived through the trauma, beginning decades of treatment as a burn survivor, and this is just a small part of her very compelling story. She brings you into the world, the dysfunctional and tragic world of her family, which includes artistic genius, narcissistic and neglectful parents, eccentricity, and four suicides. Most importantly, she explains her long but ultimately triumphant path towards love, health, and life satisfaction. Some chapters in her book, Flashback Girl, of this gripping life journey focus on early events, including the story of the horrific fire, her years of hospitalization, and multiple, I think there was over 60 reconstructive surgeries, correct me if I'm wrong, bullying and social isolation. The voice of her memoir, Flashback Girl, is warm and engaging. And despite the seriousness of the subject, the tone of her memoir is positive and humorous without self-pity. I, for one, was moved beyond words and extremely inspired by her book and her story. So, and I am grateful for her to be here today. So welcome, Dr. DeGeer. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Tammy. I'm honored to be here with you.
So your story, and I don't want to give too much of it away, but I'm dying for you to share, you know, with your readers. What prompted you, to write this book?
Yes. So I have lived a really extraordinary life. And I think there's a lot of people you'll talk to, they say, oh, I should write a book. And, you know, when people know my story, nobody says, oh, yeah, sure, you should write a book. They're like, yeah, when are you going to write that book? My story involves, this horrific fire when I was 4 years old that was set by accident, but also extremely carelessly by my mother. And also in the heat of that moment of that fire, which she again set by accident, my mother ran away to save herself and left me in that fire. And I was saved by my father and his quick thinking, and was saved again by, you know, an incredible team of burn care in Boston. And that was just the beginning of my tale. You know, I was in the hospital for much of my childhood, undergoing a series of incredibly painful and traumatic surgeries. And when I was home, I was dealing with a family that was loving, but would be hard to be more dysfunctional. So I have gone through a great deal. And when my mother died, who was my last surviving original family member, that was the point at which I said, okay, now I can write this book. And it's been a great relief to have been able to write it and to share it with other people like you.
So, your story is so, you know, complex and gut-wrenching. So if I bounce around, is by no means to disrespect any of your experiences. I just want to touch on as much as I, you know, as I'm able to, because there's so much that you have to offer. So I wanted to preface that. If I bounce around, it is in no way, shape, or form to minimize any aspect of your story. So, you know, can you, your chapter on what was involved in treating children of severe burns, third degree burns, was beyond words. You know, that I'm always amazed when I encounter something so awful that I had no idea about. You know, there's always a subject. There's always something to learn and some area of life that we're ignorant on. And what a eye-opening presentation that you gave in that chapter. Can you share some of what was so difficult about treating these third-degree burns? You know, I remember you mentioning they didn't have pain medication or the right kind of pain medication back then. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. So to set the stage, I was burned in 1967. Mm-hmm. And this was just around the time that they began to be able to keep extensively burned people alive through, you know, advances in technology and stuff. So I was very lucky to be alive, as were all my other little burned children friends on the burn unit, where I spent a great deal of my childhood, and so did they. So we were lucky to be alive and to be able to recover. But burn care still actually is very painful and difficult. But back then, you know, 40, 50 years ago, they did not believe in giving burn children pain medicine. And no one I know has a reason for that, because they did give burned adults pain medicine, but burned kids, they didn't. And so burn care involves multiple surgeries, each one of which is pretty terrifying and painful. And the dressing changes involved in burn recovery, each one of which is the most excruciating thing that you can imagine. And we had those dressing changes twice a day, every day. So it's very interesting now, because I've met a lot of burn survivors, and it's, believe me, a wonderful community of people. But when you meet an old burn survivor like me, someone who's been around for 40 or 50 years, we just kind of have a special smile for each other, because the new ones have no idea. I mean, it's bad for them, but it was basically torture for us.
And what was it that got you through? It's such something so horrific at such a young age. I could listen to those chapters. I did the audiobook version, but I could listen to those chapters over and over again. And I still don't know how you did it. Please share that with me.
So partly I had a incredibly kind and caring surgeon who took the best of care of me, Dr. John Constable. And he, you know, was my surgeon from the very first day I was injured and all the way through my adulthood. We corresponded in letters for years until he died. And so he really looked out for me, and I knew that he would take the best care of me that he possibly could. And partly my father, who was a man of great strengths and also great weaknesses, but in this case, he was He was wonderful. He brought me records and I would listen to those when I was in the hospital. And, you know, I think I'm sure there's plenty of people out there who understand the healing power of music. And I listened to show music and Disney records and all kinds of records. And I would sing along pretending I was somewhere else. And I think I am blessed with a naturally cheerful disposition. And I believed that I would get better and I would go home. And I did. And I think having that hope is really important to get through terrible things.
So, you know, I also, you know, read the heartbreaking, you know, bullying you experienced both before, during, and after your 60 plus surgeries. You know, how did you maintain hope? Because not only did you have physical pain, you had repeated abuse, emotional abuse and verbal abuse following that.
Yeah. So again, back in the 60s and 70s, bullying was not even a topic that people addressed as being a problem. You know, nowadays, if a child is bullied, usually teachers are sensitive to that and schools are sensitive to that and parents are too. But when I was a child, you know, I don't even remember that being a topic or something that one would talk about, let alone try to help a kid. And then nobody helped me. Although I guess somebody did help me. My brother was very, he was a very dear and kind soul. He was 4 years older than, 5 years older than me. And he comforted me. There was one time when a girl was threatening to beat me up and he told me he would, he said, you tell her if she beats you up, I'm going to beat her up. And even neighbors, other people out there looked out for me and were kind to me. And I think that's one of the lessons that I've learned in life is that even though some people may be devastatingly disappointing, that doesn't mean that there aren't other really good people out there who will care for you and try to help for you and to try to notice them.
So you say on your website that you are the lone surviving child of gifted, unsettled, and iconoclastic parents. Can you share a little bit about that and what you mean by that?
Yes. So I am the youngest of two children born to my parents. My mother was a classical pianist, a concert pianist, highly gifted musician. And my father was also a musical genius. He could play anything he even heard once. He could sit down on the piano and play perfectly in any key you wanted him to. And he was a college professor. They're both incredibly smart, talented, engaging people who had no business being parents. they had a lot of emotional limitations through, I suppose, in many ways, no fault of their own, which meant that they were really not emotionally available to take care of my brother and myself, to notice when we were having problems, let alone help us with any of them. And we had a lot of problems. I mean, I was a burn survivor. I was disfigured. I was incredibly traumatized. And my older brother, Mark, was someone who suffered from depression at a very early age. And my parents loved us, but did not feel compelled to help us at all, more or less ever. And we suffered the price for that. My brother died young, and maybe I'll save some of the details on that for an interested reader, but he died young. And my father died young through some degree his own folly. And my mother also died younger than she should have. So they never meant to cause any harm, either one of my parents, but they did a lot of harm, especially my mom.
What can you share a couple of experiences or situations that, you know, you had with her? But let me preface that, you know, obviously one of the worst must have been that, you know, in that grill fire that you discuss in detail at the book, she saved herself and left you there. You know, is that correct?
That is correct. And then even after that, we were both in the same hospital for months, and she could have come visit me every day and did not come for weeks, despite the fact that I was close to death a couple of times during that point, and my father would try to get her to come visit me, and she would just say, "Oh, poor Lise, I just can't do it." So that was my mom. It's not that she didn't care. It's that whatever she needed wound up being the most important thing. And she wasn't good or able, I guess, to put her needs aside for other people, even her own children who were in grave danger. And there's just countless examples of that, unfortunately.
And would you say that your dad was an enabler? Or is there more to it than that?
I don't think my dad was an enabler. I don't think he was. He was also not particularly good at putting his own children's needs first. I think he understood that a little bit more than my mom did, but not much. My dad had his own limitations. Again, this is many decades ago. My father was a closeted gay man. And back in the time when he was young, he was from a strict Roman Catholic family. And that was something, it was just not possible to have an open life as a gay man in those days. Maybe it was possible somewhere, but it wasn't possible where he grew up. And so he hid a lot of himself for many years. And I think that took a big emotional toll on him and what he had left to help anybody else, which was not much.
So how did you know that he was gay?
he told me. He told me when I was in seventh grade, he told me that. You know, he gradually came along with the times as gay rights became more of a possible thing. He became to be more open about who he was. And I think he found a path to more emotional health because of that.
So he told you in seventh grade?
He did.
So, I'm going to ask in a tongue-in-cheek manner, do you think you were ready to have that conversation with him at seventh grade?
I was not. I was not. Actually, the story on that is very funny and very my father. I told him, I finally told him, because I was so ashamed, that I told him that I was being bullied in school and that I had no friends and that I was being picked on every day and how unhappy I was. And he listened to me very carefully. And he said at the end of that, he said, "Well, thank you for telling me that secret. And now I'm going to tell you my secret." And he told me in that moment that he considered himself at that point to be bisexual. And I just remember staring at him and thinking, like, this was not the answer I expected from my father. But I guess that's a really good example of him, right? He was a lovely guy. He just shouldn't have been a parent.
Yeah, I would definitely question, you know, how helpful that was. You share something quite painful at the tender age of 12, and he spills that in response.
Yeah. He was who he was, and I have I have a lot of appreciation for my dad too. You know, he was a character, and he meant well. He really did. He just was a little bit clueless.
So, can you share a little bit about, you know, your high school, going to college years, and then perhaps what led you to become a clinical psychologist?
Sure. Yeah, I actually did wind up having very nice experiences in high school and college, made good friends, had wonderful experience at Tufts University up there in Massachusetts. And I thought about doing many things with my life. I became a psychologist I became more interested in becoming a psychologist after the death of my brother. And I guess I will share it at this point that my brother took his life. So
the one person that was consistently there for you, other than Dr. Constable, the way you needed it, committed suicide.
Yes.
Which was a horrible
and devastating loss, and still to this day feels to me to be the worst loss of my life. And that the fact that my brother, who was actually, I'm not overstating this, my brother was just in fact a genius. And I was not. I was a pretty ordinary, bright person, but not a genius, and you know, traumatized and disfigured and had gone through all these things. And the fact that my genius, perfect brother took his life, and that I, this sort of traumatized, disfigured, ugly person, was still here, propelled me into the study of wanting to understand the human mind and how some of us survive and how we can thrive and what we can do for those who are not thriving, kind of to try to understand that mystery of resilience and what it is and if we can help people become more resilient.
Yes, well, I looked up awe-inspiring and resilience in the Google Merriam-Webster Dictionary, and your picture was there. Just in case you're wondering.
Great.
So can you share, you know, and again, I am bouncing all over the place, but I want to try to touch on everything because I'm so grateful with how much you have to offer the listeners. Can you share a little bit about what, you know, your parents, you know, whatever their limitations were, how that contributed to your, you know, brother's suicide and unhappiness?
Yeah. So my brother did suffer from depression. I think partly because our parents were so limited and he didn't have a lot of support and help. He suffered from depression. And that was something that everybody understood to be true, but nobody really did anything to help him with. So he was not in treatment. He was not brought to
So he never saw a therapist or got any kind of counseling of any kind?
He declined. Yeah. But when I say that, he was a minor. So he could have been, you know, encouraged strongly and brought as I think those of us with troubled children do. You know, if your 15-year-old says they would like to kill themselves, but they don't want to go to therapy, you don't say, oh, okay. Right?
That is true. That is very true.
That's not the answer. That is not the answer. So he was not brought to treatment. And he said he didn't want to try medicine. And my parents basically sort of took that as being the answer. And then they just stopped looking out for him. By the time we were 17, we had moved away from our family home. And my brother basically bounced from a friend's house to a friend's house to a friend's house for a couple years. Went to college, dropped out, went back. And there was really no adult eyes on him And when he was 19, he took his life.
Well, I am very, you know, sorry. And I have a lot of sympathy for what you've, you know, gone through, and how you're able to turn that into something positive is just, there are no words for that. So when you went to college and then you decided to get a doctorate in clinical psychology, and was it a direct path? Like you were going to get a doctorate, you're going to open up your practice, or, you know, was it not quite so linear?
It was a direct path from college to graduate school because I was very determined to get that done. But my career has covered a lot of ground. I worked for a while at in some physical rehab hospitals. I worked in, you know, stroke rehab and spinal cord rehab. And then I turned to more general mental health settings. And now I'm in private practice for the last, I don't know, part-time for the last 20 years and full-time for the last 16. And I love my work. I mean, you know, that doesn't mean I just enjoy every day, you know, getting out of bed and starting working. But in general, I love being able to help people who are suffering. And I think that's one of the great gifts of having suffered, is that it means that there's a depth to the way that you can listen to somebody, and a comfort I think you can give someone, just not even saying a word, but knowing that it is possible to make it through great suffering and still build a beautiful life. And it might take a long time and it might not be easy, but it can be done.
Can you tell me a little bit about at what point did the bullying stop? And migration into some normal social life? Can you share a little bit how you're able to do that?
Yeah, although I
use the term normal loosely, so
I know. I feel like that is a complicated question with a complicated answer. First of all, I have always had some friends. There was always one or two kids at least that I could connect with.
No matter how bad the bullying was, you always had that one or two?
Maybe they weren't always people I went to school with, but
right.
I'm a friendly, upbeat, kind-hearted person, and usually there's somebody who can see that beyond how I might have looked at the time. And then gradually, with all my surgeries, I look better and better. I'm still burned, and you would still notice it, but it's nowhere near as bad as it was. I mean, I started off, I didn't have a bottom lip. I didn't have a chin. I didn't have a neck. I have all those things now, and they look pretty good, you know? So, and still, I want to say, I mean, no one would bully me now. I'm a, you know, doctor in my 50s, but it is still not easy being a disfigured person in this world. And there are still plenty of people who will stare in a way that's uncomfortable, or offer commentary in a way that is painful. So I'm not bullied anymore, but it's still not a walk in the park.
Right. I figure that there's always, you know, lingering challenges.
Gotcha.
So, What age, you know, did your parents pass away? I like to sort of give timelines for people so that they, for me, you know, my goal in this podcast always is to give people that, no matter how long it takes or at what age you lose your parents or don't, you know, your toxic parents, lose them, don't lose them, that, you know, the healing journey is not linear, but worth it. So, you know, that's why I'm asking, you know, the time frame when your parents passed away and when you, you know, got married and had children, if you could share
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So my dad lived into his mid 60s and my mom lived into her early 80s. And I went through many, many years of trying to understand them, I went through plenty of therapy myself in trying to understand them and how I was affected by those relationships and how I might want to do things differently. I did my best to get along with them. I would say that, you know, for those people out there who understand these terms, they were both to some degree pretty narcissistic people. And it took me a long time to really understand that and how I might need to protect myself emotionally. I think anybody who's had difficult parents understands what I mean. And I will say, I'm just going to, you know, take a slight tangent here. It's very interesting with this book, Flashback Girl, because I always thought, like, well, if I write this book, I'm going to hear from a lot of burn survivors, and I have. But the second largest group of readers that I have heard from are people with toxic parents.
Ding, ding, ding. That would be me.
Yeah. And in particular, people with toxic mothers.
Yeah.
Because I think there is not a lot of openly written, honest stuff out there for those of us that's been our journey. And I think my book is a story about that. So,
Your book was incredible. I'm jumping around. Could you share a little bit about, you know, you went into detail on, you know, first degree burns, second degree burns, mm-hmm. third degree burns, and the grafting, mm-hmm. Without giving away too much, because everyone needs to read this book. Can you share a little information on how challenging and painful and grueling it was? Can you do that?
Sure. So when you are third degree burned, what that means is that the burns have penetrated enough layers of your skin, because the skin has seven layers, it's penetrated down enough layers and burned them away that your skin can no longer regenerate on its own. So then that means that you will require grafting, which is when they kind of shave off some good skin from an unburned place and then sew it into place over the wound that won't heal without it. And so because, you know, 2/3 of me was third degree burned, that's a lot of grafting. And that's a lot of, you know, areas of my, you know, 1/3 of my body just kind of regenerating and regenerating skin that would then be shaved away, sewn somewhere else, and then had to heal again. So in addition to that, if you're a burned child, of course you're growing, right? You're growing taller and wider as you mature. So then that skin needs to be grafted and regrafted again, because burned skin won't really grow. And then when you add on to that, you know, many of us who are burned have burned faces. So we require, you know, very delicate plastic surgery to try to reconstruct as best they can, or burned hands that need to be fingers that need to be reconstructed. And I could go on and on. I mean, you're basically trying as best they can to reconstruct the body parts. So every one of those things is a painstaking operation. And every one of those things requires these horrific bandage changes that were, you know, basically the nightmares of our existence. I would like to say, for anybody who knows someone who's burned now, that it's still really hard, but they're much better with pain relief now. So don't fear that, oh my God, that means that's what's going to happen to my child or whatever. Like, they do a much better job of handling the pain now. So that part is much, 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 much better.
I'm very glad to hear that. And I could probably have you on here for another 30 hours. but I want everyone to read your book. So I am going to deliberately avoid asking any more questions, as challenging as that is for me. So you are a blogger for Psychology Today. You've been featured in Thrive Global, Tiny Buddha, The Elephant Journal. You've appeared on NPR, NBC, ABC, Fox, and Sirius XM. And now she feels extra privileged to be on my podcast in comparison to ABC and Fox, I'm sure.
I am so happy to be with you today.
I am going to put the link to her website and her book in the show notes, but I'm going to read it right now. Her website is lisedeguire.com. I'll say it one more time. lisedeguire.com. And I hope you all run out and buy her book, because I found it empowered me to stay hopeful no matter how challenging a situation is. And I want to personally thank you for giving me a new tool in my emotionally intelligent toolkit to utilize going forward. So thank you.
Well, thank you. In addition to that, let me just say one little thing, Tammy, if you don't
Absolutely.
Mind.
Absolutely.
My husband always says to me, you've got to tell them that the book is Flashback Girl. And even though it talks about all these really heavy and difficult things, it's a page turner.
It is.
And it is written with warmth and heart and humor. And it's not as much of a bummer as you might think.
No, your tone was fantastic. Yeah. Because I was able to, you know, as gut-wrenching as, you know, your detailed descriptions of your surgeries were, your positivity, you know, definitely leaked through every challenging chapter. So it worked for me, and I think it will work for my reader, our listeners too.
And thank you so much. And I really appreciate having the chance to talk to you today and to connect with whoever is out there who needs a little hope and inspiration in this time that we're living through. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Lise, and have a great day. And I hope to have you back.
Absolutely.
Take care.
Thank you. You too.
You have been listening to The Stuck Stops Here. This is LW Noli. Join us again next time as we continue getting unstuck from generational emotional abuse and breaking free from toxic generational behavior patterns.